Arriving in Sweden, three I can remember. One I laughed about as it was plucked from my brother. The second, having watched the first being removed, I knew what to do with the alcohol and the pin. The third was much later, after a camping trip in Scotland, I discovered it plump and swollen, nestled in the warm fold of my armpit. This one I covered in Vaseline and it dropped off, disappearing as suddenly as it had appeared. Since moving to Sweden, I've had many more encounters with these arachnids. They appear with surprising frequency. I lose count of numbers. I seem to be particularly attracted to them. Maybe I produce high levels of the chemicals they seek. Maybe my interests and lifestyle cause me to brush up against their perches more frequently than other people. Regardless, I now have regular encounters with these creatures. My early encounters with ticks echoed through my more recent responses. Initially, my reactions were disgust and horror, looking for the least surgical and fastest options. I called for Vaseline or alcohol to drown, poison, or suffocate this puncturer of my skin. I wanted it removed, but I did not want to be active in its removal. Just as I wanted it to disappear, to somehow dissolve it, to wash it from my skin like it was the speck of dirt or the piece of fluff that it resembled. This response was a denial that I had become host to a parasite, that the thin membrane that I hold to be my surface had been punctured. To pluck a tick, to mechanically draw it from the skin, was an admission that it had transgressed that boundary. It required me to recognize that it wanted to stay, to resist the tweezers and my pull, and in that minute battle of wills, bodies would be broken, most probably the ticks, but that part of the tick might be left behind, requiring further pulling, scratching, delving, prying into my skin, and the possible infection of my body. The methods I used for removal ticks before I moved to Sweden are not recommended. While they are less mechanical, there is a possibility that the tick ejects the contents of its digestive system during the process. Thus, plucking ticks is favoured in an attempt to limit infection. In the meantime, I have learnt the tickle that a tick causes as it crosses my skin. I routinely check my body after being in the forest or fields around my home. Friends and family have been infected with Borrelia, though thankfully all have, that's Lyme disease. Though thankfully all have been spared the long suffering this complicated infection can cause. Others are not so lucky. Armstrong et al. Note in relation to Borrelia, perceptions of risk can be exaggerated in areas of high tick population and leading to what Shapiro and Gerbera describe as Lyme anxiety. I have asked for the blood tests for Borrelia. I have paid the high fees to be vaccinated against another tick-borne disease common in Sweden, TBE. Once removed, I've learnt to squish the ticks between my thumbnails. I've heard stories of burning them with matches, flushing them down the lavatory, dropping them into water containing washing up liquids. Many methods, all designed to ensure that ticks are dead and stay dead. Ticks might fit into the category that was talked about earlier today and yesterday, or the categories uncomfortable, Kirksey calls unloved. My paper today is an attempt to work through the encounters with ticks, to work through the uncomfortable, unpleasant, and unwelcome aspects of our social worlds. And I want to do this within the theoretical register of symbiosis. It is an uncomfortable fit. So I want to begin by developing some of the geographies of ticks before I then move on to review some of the symbiotic theory present in current discussions of human-animal encounters, and then articulate some of the reasons why I see it as a remaining a powerful tool before finally coming to some sort of critique and on its current usage and how it may or may not apply to ticks and how an expanded notion might be helpful. So, the ticks. There are more, It says more than 907 species of tick. So to talk about ticks is obviously doing a violence. There's a variety of tick worlds. They are arachnids with between 6 and 8 legs at various stages of their life cycle. Some of them have very, very specific hosts. Mick Smith talks about a tick that only feeds on a particular lizard that lives on a particular island off of New Zealand. Others are much more general. Most often they are feeding on mammalian blood, but not exclusively so. Birds, as I say, reptiles, and even other ticks. The distribution. Ticks, or the species of ticks, have covered the entire globe, including polar regions. I think this is one of the ways that these little, obviously smaller than a mouse, critters disrupt our notions of scale. The life cycle of the life cycle of the tick moves through this process of, we'll start with the egg to larva to nymph to adult, each stage requiring a blood meal. So there are at least 3 blood meals. I can't talk about ticks without making some sort of reference to Von Uxkull and the triad of perceptual keys of butyric acid butyric acid, temperature and tactile hairiness. And then the temporalities that Uxkull also mentions, the fact that this tick, he makes this reference to a tick that was kept isolated in a test tube for 18 years without nourishment. And I think we'll be talking about disrupting notions of scale, the fact there's 3 meals. We could talk about 18 years between each one. We're talking about ticks when they come to lay eggs, the possibility of being 56 years or more in age is a another way we can disrupt those scales. So that's some of the life cycle, the biologies of ticks. Disease, human health is a key factor in tick geographies in Sweden at the moment. There has been some research that suggests that tick bites can lead to red meat allergy in humans, as it offers a route by which red meat proteins can enter the blood of us, thereby triggering immune responses to blood proteins. Borrelia is a significant disease that is very widespread. A slightly more local disease that is causing ticks to raise their profile in Sweden at the moment is TBE, tick-borne encephalitis virus. I don't know of many other diseases that the name of the disease is about the vector that transmits the disease. I think there's one about mosquitoes. It's quite often about where it originated, who first was infected, who first discovered it, and final species that is affected by it. But ticks being the vector, the thing that passed by and aren't affected. So I think tick-borne encephalitis is one of these things. It's big in Sweden at the moment. This is a map of the TB risk here. This is the region where of Sweden where the risk is highest, and there's also a little bit on the west coast. But as you can see, there's I would say sort of some sort of historical geopolitics. Not so historical, having had a Russian submarine off in the archipelago of Stockholm a couple of weeks ago. There's a lot of fear, I think, in this. In the Swedish discussions about where it's coming from, it's yeah, it's an uncomfortable conversation, and also who it's affecting. The archipelago regions where it's most prevalent is an area where there's a lot of recreation, a lot of boating, a lot of yachting. So its presence in the media is yeah. But it's not insignificant. The death rate is between 0.5 and 20%. It can cause long-term neurological damage in up to 60% of patients. And there's a growing number of infections in Sweden at the moment. At the moment, it's around about 200 infections per year, but it's been growing, and it goes up and down with tick populations. The response to this has been around vaccination, primarily. And there are these vans that... the vaccination is not state-funded. It's a private... or you pay for it yourself. They're quite high fees. It's a three-phase vaccination. And each costing about, I would say, about between 30 and 50... £50 that has to be repeated every 3 years. And these vans go round to make sure that people can get their shots and have their vaccination updated. It's tying... Vaccination ties together different species. It's developed through mice brains and chicken embryos, tested on mice, grown on egg protein, and stabilised with human albumin, the primary component in blood plasma. So it's tying together lots of species, as many vaccines do, all vaccines. And then there is also environmental management responses. So we might talk in the domestic setting, we might talk about the spot-on treatments that put on pets. The main active ingredients in those are fipronil, but also might include a range of they're not as dangerous as the organophosphates that they replace, but they still cause very high toxicities to other pet species, to aquatic organisms and insects. So there's this kind of toxic discourse and practice on the domestic level. There's also been calls to kill all of the deer in a region, in order to lower tick populations. If you look at the life cycle of the ticks, if you look at the temporalities of the tick's life cycle, then these policies seem completely crazy. But they're there. They're there in the popular and in the scientific discourse. And then also toxic deer. This is a spot-on treatment for deer. This is, I think this isn't going on in Sweden at the moment. I read about this the other day. It's coming in the US, where they are treating deer. They set out feed stations, and then whilst they're feeding, pick up these chemicals that will then kill the ticks and many other insects. There's also on a wider level, I'm going to skip over that because I haven't got time. I'm running out of time, I can see. So I'm saying that ticks occupy some interesting spaces. They're definitely uncomfortable. They are, I would say, unloved. But they may be to follow Myra Hurd in the sense that the life cycles don't fit in with these environmental responses. They may be indifferent to many human geographies that are going on in response to them. So despite this relative indifference on the part of the ticks, I'd argue that ticks are companion species, in Haraway's terms. As humans and ticks are tied together in a loop where human blood is circulated through a tick, and then ticks don't excrete while they're feeding. They return the excrement back into the body of the host organism. So we're caught in a loop of disgust and digestion. I'm disgusted as it's digesting me. binding together inside and outside in a loop of mutual becoming with. This, I feel, is in Haraway's terms. And I might point to the way that ticks have taught me different tickles as they trace across my skin, the surveillance of my body after I've been in different parts of the countryside, the diffuse toxicologies created through spot-on treatments, and the networks of more than human dependencies that go into production of vaccinations. For those living with the long-standing implications of the diseases that ticks transmit, there are clearly ontological implications. But to talk about ticks in these same creative registers that seems to dominate the companion species discussions is a difficult political move. I've been told that ticks don't fit in repeatedly in animal studies presence. They just don't fit in. They're not welcome. And I've been told that parasitism and symbiosis is they don't fit in there either. So this is kind of my response to try and crowbar them in and say, but we maybe could think about it in these terms. The reasons I want to hold on to symbiosis are fourfold, and I think this repeats some of the things that have been discussed throughout these sessions. The first is sort of the descriptive. I've missed a slide. I'm very sorry. This is a front cover of a tabloid saying infected by a new horror tick. So the horror is there. So symbiosis defined as close and sustained associations between differently named organisms. I've got another mollusk for those who were counting mollusks. I like symbiosis for sort of four or three levels, the first one being divided into the descriptive character of symbiosis around the origins of life through Margulis's ideas about symbiosis, that genetic material becomes incorporated into cells not through spot mutations but through exchanges between species, and how the mitochondria and chloroplasts drive not only everyday life, but also provided the excess energy for evolution. So the power of its descriptive register to talk about the origins of life, I find very attractive. The discussions of individual and group development. McFall and Guy point to the work that bacteria play in the development of individual bodies, talking, and the mollusk here, that are the specific encounters with bacteria at early stages during the Hawaiian bobtail squid's life allows it to develop the organs that will later house those same bacteria and creates this bioluminescence. And a little bit of what was talked about in Jamie's presentation or in the questions at the end, Cryan and Dinan, 2012, identify the link between microbiome of organisms and behaviours. I'm reticent about the risks of new forms of biodeterminisms that such pathways might lead, but the power of symbiotic couplings in individual and group development I find very helpful. But alongside this descriptive power, I would also say that symbiosis has been used as a critique. Myra Hurd's provocative and exuberant work sets out the compelling arguments regarding how the social sciences and humanities would benefit from thinking with bacteria. And she uses it to critique the emphasis on the notion of the individual human subject that pervades social sciences and humanities, with the individual, according to her, a consequence of the pervasive neo-Darwinian rhetoric within the sciences and humanities and popular discourse, Its zoocentric focus, by which herd following Margulis means eukaryotes that are big like us, rather than the overwhelming majority of microbial life, has resulted in theories that foreground the individual over the emphasis on interactions overemphasis on interactions such as conflict and competition between individuals at the expense of how organisms shape one another. And this is a sort of part of a long kind of critique within the history of symbiosis stretching back hundreds of years. And then as a sort of, I termed this as a political tool, but Ebden Kirksey, in a description of the multi-species dynamics in wetland reserves in Costa Rica, discusses how various species are incorporated into a Latourian parliament of things. In an account of cattails, or the rhizomous plants known in English as bulrush, the codependencies of the cattail within the wider ecology became better understood. By increasing this understanding and these codependencies, the cattails gained their spokesperson that allowed them to be incorporated, managed within ecosystems rather than subject to the extermination policies that had previously been implemented. And in a similar vein, I would suggest that symbiosis operates as a mechanism by which non-humans might be brought into a Latourian multi-species democracy. That through identifying codependencies between species, unloved species might be advocated for as people recognize what they contribute. What I find difficult is the way that then reverts into a discussion of care ethics. And I find it very difficult to care for a tick. It's not a sentiment unique to me. In the face of the threats to human and companion animal health, drastic environmental policies accompany the personal practices of killing, as I mentioned earlier. While people crush, burn, and otherwise dispose of ticks using a variety of chemical and mechanical means, we add toxic chemicals to the coats of our pets to protect them and us from tick presence. And the spread in Sweden of TBE have called for these widespread culling of deer. So I'm kind of tempering my enthusiastic engagement with symbiosis with a concern that sometimes it feels like symbiosis is everywhere and therefore causes me to ask, well, but how do I use it? Symbiotic theory seems a very useful register to be talking about human-animal relations. It operates at the descriptive, critical, and political levels, but as it can seemingly apply to all relations, it can seem that we are inundated by symbiosis. While it seems that symbiosis is everywhere, there also appears to be what I would suggest unhelpful exclusions. Ticks and parasites more generally do not often fit within the discussions of symbiosis as it is currently framed in animal studies literature and beyond. I would suggest that the current frames of becoming with have an unnecessary emphasis on the creative. Creative here is not to be equated with good, far from it, but that there is an emphasis on what emerges through symbiosis rather than what is lost or what is diffused. As I said that the creative emphasis in the register of companion meetings is not good, and I would add that it is not only fluffy Haraway and companionability. Haraway and Frecaro, for example, when they engage with symbiosis, are always engaging in mortal games. But I would suggest that the mortality discussed is often set against what is created through codependency. Mortality takes a particular ontological form. It is generated through these mortal politics. With ticks, we have what I would call a parasitic diffusion. The associations that tick make are not crystallized in recognizable forms. The female tick, swollen on its blood meal, though still smaller than a mouse, bursts to release a proliferation of eggs. But rather, I have two more paragraphs. But rather than when Haraway or Freckero engage with symbiosis, they talk in a framework infused by what I would say an emphasis on commensalisms and mutualisms. Living together of differently named species is much more diverse. This is not to dismiss the current use of symbiosis, but to suggest that we might expand the notion of symbiosis and be more specific about what, and maybe multiple, forms of symbiosis are being implemented. So mutualism is where both parties to the relationship benefit. Commensalism is where one party benefits and the other is not noticeably affected. And this, I feel, is the register of current discussions of symbiosis. But given the very broad definition of symbiosis, living together of two differently named species, we might include other forms of human-animal relations. Amensalisms, where one species is obliterated by another. Synecrosis, where both species are detrimentally affected, and of course, parasitism. As it talks about intensity in terms of proximity and temporality, symbiosis offers a good framework for negotiating significant otherness, which would include ticks. My point here is that by maintaining a broad umbrella of symbiosis, we can retain much of the descriptive and critical benefit, but through greater specificity of how particular relationships are mutualistic, commensurate, or parasitic, we might build better descriptions of when, where, and how species meet. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much, Jacob.
I've overrun a little, so I'm very sorry.